Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode number 149 of Unblocking Crypto. Hour one away from 150.
Yeah, 149, pretty big number. Like Bitcoin hit 100,000. That's a pretty nice round number. We're going to hit 150 about the same time. I like that.
Yeah, that'd be awesome if it happened that quick. I was talking with somebody else, and we hit 100K, and it was almost boring. Like, wasn't exciting going up what we'd had in the past few weeks, so going from, 60K to 90K and beyond in a handful of weeks. Like, it just, I don't know. I know Michael Saylor was expecting for this to happen on January 1st, to have a 100K party on January 1st, and it happened like a month early. And no one's prepared.
Yeah, I was kind of paying attention to it, but I didn't think it would break 100,000. There was a big sell wall. There's maybe 4,000 Bitcoin for sale right at 100,000. So literally I'm selling covered calls for MicroStrategy, and we're just going to keep bouncing off this 100. You know, it's going to take a while to eat through this. Next thing I know, I'm getting a text message from people like 100,000 Bitcoin. I'm like, no way. Check the chart. Oh, look at that. Like 101,000, 102,000. Yeah. Like we kind of just smashed right through that sell wall. And I was like, oh crap. Like I need to dump these covered calls. And then everything kind of went back down. I honestly, MicroStrategy went down even though we were still over 100,000. So I agree. Aside from some text messages, it wasn't that big of a deal. I couldn't even scrounge up a lunch with my buddies that like Bitcoin that we usually get together. It was like, oh, I'm not feeling too good. I got to go out of town. I'm busy. Like nobody wants to do any celebrating or like cheersing glasses or anything like that. So it's kind of surprising.
Yeah. I mean, what's crazy is I was looking at some of the numbers too. So BlackRock hit with their Bitcoin ETF, 50 million in assets under management in record time. So they did it in 228 days, which is more than 5x faster than any other ETF in history. So, and they just took in like $2.5 billion in the last 5 days. So even with Bitcoin having all these pullbacks and all this stuff, the amount of money flowing into Bitcoin in general is amazing. And if you look at BlackRock, their ETF, they've taken in more this year than all but two of the last 2,800 plus ETFs that were launched in the last 10 years have taken in their entire lifetime. So it's crazy to think about how much money is flowing into Bitcoin. And what's crazy is countries really haven't started. More than half the investment banks haven't really let any of their clients into any sort of Bitcoin ETFs. Like states are talking about now doing strategic reserves, as well as the US government and others as well. So it's just kind of a wild time right now.
Well, if we're going to talk about like bullish about Bitcoin stuff, I can jump in on that. I had the same thing written down in my notes for the IBIT $1 billion, which is, you know, when January we were talking about this, it was like, well, if they all combine to get like a net $10 billion worth of inflows, you know, that would be a real success. And 15 was like the highest estimate that anybody had. And I don't recall what the net inflows are for everything, but you know we're in the 20s, right?
The net,
yeah.
Well, I think we're over that. I don't.
We blew everything out of the water without the major institutions. Like we talked about, it takes them 6 to 9 months to approve and do their due diligence and all these things. And honestly, the Wells Fargo, the Bank of America's, the monster guys aren't in, and even like the Merrill Lynch's. They're like, well, if you have a net worth over a large amount and you have a high risk tolerance, then we can, you know, we'll talk and this and that. So it's still not easy for these people to get in. And so, you know, we're looking at like S-curve adoption, right? Like most technologies get adopted on an S-curve where everything starts really slowly with these early adopters, and then it picks up and ramps up and then gets kind of vertical, and then it kind of slows down as it reaches more, it kind of saturates the market. And, you know, everybody wants to talk about cycles, and this is, you know, these halving cycles and what happens. And I'm like, look, it's either going to be a typical cycle, which means if you look at the previous cycles, anywhere from a $200,000 Bitcoin to like 4 million, because those first cycles were a little crazy. or it's going to be better than that, which means it's either higher or it lasts longer, or it's worse than that, which means it's lower or shorter. I'm like, all this stuff, is it really going to be the worst cycle? Are we really going to not get, like, it does not feel like we're going to do worse than we did the last cycle. And that would be the worst one because, you know, the price really didn't spike. We didn't have that hyperbolic, you know, sharp peak. We had like two rounded double tops. And so I'm like, man, if we just beat that one, we're well into the 200s. And it doesn't, you know, in my head, it's like, man, it takes a lot of money. A lot of money's got to flow in, but you're still selling at the margin. And so it's really only that last Bitcoin that's for sale on the exchanges that sets the price. So you do need money inflowing, but you don't, it's not a one-to-one ratio of like, well, you need twice as much inflows at 100,000 as you do at 50. You know, there's a velocity of money that comes into play and things like that. So if all these guys pour in, if these institutions pour in at the same time that, you know, when Trump takes office, if he just says, hey, these 200,000 Bitcoin are now getting transferred from the Marshals to the Treasury, and they're now part of a strategic stockpile, that's enough to send the price higher as countries are poured in. And countries, so I'm getting a lot of smoke. It kind of stinks because there's a lot of guys in Bitcoin that are aware of things that are going on, but they're under non-disclosure agreements, so they can't talk about it. But a lot of them are indicating there's countries that are looking at getting into strategic reserves. So if I was a country, I would, if there's a better than 50% chance that the United States is going to do it, then I would like to front run them. And so I'd say in the next 2 or 3 months, we're going to see a lot of action.
Yeah, I agree completely. I was trying to look up how much of the inflows happen in the Bitcoin ETFs, and I don't know that exact number, but I can say there's over 100 million assets under management just alone in the US Bitcoin ETFs. So I know Grayscale had a bunch of outflows, but they're only 20 million of that 100 million. So
billion, you mean?
Sorry, billion, yes. 20 billion of that 100 billion. So yeah, there's definitely been a lot. And in terms of momentum, I mean, I think the other thing that was kind of exciting to see here in the past week was they've named this crypto and AI czar in the Trump administration. So one of the podcasters, David Sacks, who's part of the All In podcast, he's also kind of part of that whole PayPal mafia that happened back in the day. He is now going to be in charge of crypto and AI for the Trump administration. And I think they're still working on what that committee would look like. But I mean, if you look at him and what he said about Bitcoin back in 2013 was he called Bitcoin the new internet. And he said back in 2013, he was buying then. So, I mean, it's great to have somebody that's pro crypto that is looking into this. And I don't know, I'm excited to see where this goes. I think there's still some question marks on what's going to happen because there isn't a lot of details, but you have somebody who understands crypto and AI and startups in general that should be very open to making sure we have the right regulations in place and move forward.
Yeah, I like this David Sacks move a lot for Bitcoin and crypto. And so you hit a lot of the points that I'd like to make. I don't agree with everything that he says on the podcast. I agree with a lot of what he says. And he's a reasonable person that will admit when he's wrong. And like, he's kind of got a similar like anti-war stance as me. And like, so I view him as someone who thinks similar to me, which I don't get a lot of politicians or people involved in politics that think a lot like me. So I'll eat it up all day.
You can count that on one hand.
And so I'll take it, man, all day. But one thing that I like that is kind of outside of just the selection of him is, you know, I don't really like the SAR title, but I think that's kind of a weird thing that America picked up that probably shouldn't have. But linking crypto and AI together helps. Like, everybody's on board with AI. If you're not on board with AI, you're like a Luddite and anti-technology and all these things. There are plenty of people that are super wary of crypto and think it's a hoax or a scam or all these things. So by putting crypto and AI together and lumping them together into this title, I think that helps to lend more credibility to crypto in just like the most basic, like kind of marketing way, where you start to hear crypto AI together. Everybody's on board with AI. Tons of people are using AI on their phones to answer questions and things like that. So it makes, to me, there's just a little bit of a softening of that barrier between non-crypto users and crypto being something that just happens. So, you know, you use AI on your phone, you use crypto on your phone. Like AI is going to be running in the background of a lot of software. Crypto is probably going to get used by the AI in order to transfer value to each other from these AI agents. So, I mean, honestly, you know, from a looking forward standpoint, you know, putting crypto and AI together makes a lot of sense, because I think that they'll be interlinked as far as that's how AI will communicate value. But in the short term, I think it's great just to knock down some of these barriers. So yeah, I'm all about it.
Yeah. I mean, if you're AI, who are you going to trust? And I don't think they're going to trust some random government official sitting in some ivory tower saying, here's what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. They're going to be something that is sensor resistant and is tradable 24/7, 365. And so, yeah, I think the crypto and AI is a perfect marriage and will continue to be something that happens moving forward.
Also, yeah, well, if you, I haven't asked Grok this, but if I did ask Grok, would you rather use US dollars that settle in 2 or 3 days, or would you rather use Bitcoin or crypto that can settle in seconds in order to transfer value? Which would you select? Right. I mean, I just listened to somebody talk about how, oh, we've already got the US dollar. The system that we have already transfers everything digitally. And I'm like, man, but it sucks. It sucks and it's old, and it's like it's a shoehorned old way that's crammed into this new technology. Like, so, you know, I think that AI would answer it in the way that I would expect them to want to use at least crypto, if not Bitcoin.
No, I agree. So the other thing that Trump did announce too is he announced his pick for the new SEC chair. So Paul Akins, who is a pro crypto previous SEC commissioner. And honestly, I haven't read too much about him. I'm, I guess, excited that there's somebody pro crypto that's going to be in the space. And it sounds like he's going to be very open to moving crypto forward and trying to fix the whole Gary Gensler mess. And I'll be interested to see where it goes from there, Tim.
Yeah, I've never heard of this guy, but I've listened to a couple people talk about him, and they seem to be on board with it. Good news for him, bar's really low. All you have to do is not be as bad as Gary Gensler, and you're a breath of fresh air. So low bar for him, and people expect him to do well and be pro-crypto, but non-pro, you know, I don't want him to be pro-crypto in a way that's clumsy and awful. Like, just say, you know, like, just set the regulations, just do everything right. Take your time, 6 months, 12 months, you know, let's get some things rolled out. To me, no big deal. And if Elon and Vivek make government workers come back to the office, then the SEC might be able to actually get something done, because they're one of the groups that only has their employees there 2 days a month.
You know what I did see too? So the CEO of Coinbase came out and told law firms that they won't do any business with any company that hires ex-SEC lawyers. And that if they want a list of everybody involved, just to DM him, because he has it. So, I mean, there's probably going to be a changeover, because there's a different perspective coming in that is almost the complete opposite of what the Gary Gensler regime was. But that, I mean, that's kind of a big deal for law firms. If you don't want the Coinbases and the other crypto companies that are kind of the future of needing lawyers for a lot of different things, stay away from the people that were ex-SEC.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know quite a few lawyers, and it's a weird thing that they do, where they do whatever they're assigned to do by law. Even if they're like a defense attorney and they know the guy's guilty, they still got to try to, you know, get him the best deal they can. It's like, if you work for the SEC and you're an attorney, then you're basically a defense attorney for the SEC. So you're doing, even if you don't believe in what you're doing, you're still doing it the best you can for your client. So one, I think that kind of sucks for the attorneys that were working at SEC that kind of got looped into this. But two, it should make attorneys second guess, like, okay, maybe in this SEC job isn't the thing I want to do. I don't know. I don't necessarily like discriminating against people who kind of got rolled into this. Like Gary Gensler's one thing, right? He's setting the tone. He's taking orders effectively from Elizabeth Warren. And honestly, when he was assigned or appointed to MIT, he understands blockchain. Like he looked good. And so something happened to him where he's just been an awful representative for kind of balance. And so, yeah, I'm hanging on him. But man, if you're like way down the line being an attorney for the SEC, I don't know if I agree with lumping them in, but like sending a message that, hey, this sucks and you didn't do anything about it. Like I'm cool to send a message. It's not like every company in America said, we're not going to hire you. So they can go get a job somewhere else.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where if those lawyers come out and say this was a problem, then maybe, right? But yeah, I don't know. They've caused a lot of harm in the crypto industry, and I'm okay with them going to find a different industry to work in.
Right? Yeah, that's fair.
So Coinbase has a ton of news here in the past week. Earlier this year, they sued the FDIC after they were denied the Freedom of Information Act. So what Coinbase ended up doing here recently is they shared some letters from the FDIC back from March of 2022 that pretty much proved that Operation Choke Point 2.0 happened. And we talked a little bit about this last week, but the letter pretty much said, hey, it's a proposed fintech product. The FDIC has not yet determined what or if any regulatory filings will be necessary for a bank to engage in this type of activity. So as a result, we respectfully ask you that you pause all crypto asset related activity. And that went to a lot of the banks. And I mean, it's caused quite a bit of a turmoil for people that I think pay attention to this. Because if you look at one of the attorneys for Coinbase, he's like, hey, law abiding American businesses should be able to access banking services without any government interference. And that's hasn't been the case. And I mean, we talked about like that last week with Mark Andreessen saying he knew 30 tech founders that were just said, you're not allowed to bank with us anymore from different banks. So, and even the CTO of Silvergate, which is one of the large banks that was one of the three crypto banks that pretty much was forced to kind of dissolve. They said the regulators pretty much did a bait and switch on him and then shot him in the back due to Choke Point 2.0. So, and I was reading too, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, she came out and said that the Silvergate failure was disappointing but predictable because probably she has some her fingers in the FDIC.
Yeah, I can't believe Silvergate was definitely predictable. It was definitely going to die. I shot it.
Yeah. And even David Sacks has kind of come out and said that Choke Point 2.0 needs to be looked at. So he's realized it and he's talking about it and he's now got a pretty influential voice in this new administration coming up.
Yeah, and I won't double up too much on the Choke Point 2.0 stuff, but you know, when Canada had the truckers protest and they shut down the bank accounts and licenses and all these different things of these truckers to shut them up, and the donors that backed them, if you donated to them, you also got into where your bank account was locked out and things like that. That's pretty, it's super parallel to Choke Point 2.0. Hey, I want to start a business doing this. Poof, I'm eliminated from the banking system. Like it's a freedom issue. It's a freedom of speech issue. And so, and you know, pursuit of happiness issue where, you know, you want to go in a certain direction and the government with no due process, there's no trial, there's no crime. You're just locked out of the financial industry. And if you don't have the freedom to transact, then you really don't have much freedom at all. I mean, you've got to do whatever the government says in order for you to get back to having a bank account. Because without a bank account, credit card, et cetera, good luck having a company. So I think it's a big problem. Looking forward to it getting resolved based on the flood of pro-crypto people that are getting appointed to every position. I can't imagine that this goes on. You know, it may come back 4 years from now, but for the next 4 years, I think these crypto companies are going to be able to smash the gas and get as much headway as they can get. And I think they know that because if the election goes the other way and blue team's back, then they may hammer back down on the headwinds and put a bunch of roadblocks in their way. So I think you'll see a ton of innovation and entrepreneurship kind of blooming from the crypto industry as soon as they release all these issues.
Yeah, and with issues or with innovation come issues, I guess, too. So Coinbase seems to be having a lot of issues with restricting accounts right now. And so I've been reading a little bit about that. And part of it is because of the use of VPNs, which I believe is kind of a necessary to protect your security. But yeah, what Coinbase is saying is that all hackers use VPNs. I want to be like, well, all smart people use VPNs. So figure out a way around it. I think Kraken even came out and said, hey, VPNs are what's necessary almost for you to be using to protect your data. So I think Coinbase is in the midst of fixing this. And in the meantime, they also added Apple Pay for their on-ramp support for free onboarding and offboarding and using USDC. So they're doing a lot. Of course, they'll continue to be more crypto friendly and there'll be growing pains as always, but at least it's heading in the right direction.
Yeah, the one thing I saw about this was Coinbase put a tweet out that said, we're not restricting accounts. And the community notes said, they are restricting accounts. Like, man, if for all of the you know, the social media isn't great for everything and stuff, Twitter is approaching as good as I think you can get, where the community, you read something, you're like, oh, okay, Coinbase is just getting a bad rap. It's some bad article, or, you know how these things go. A couple of people had a restricted account. It was some kind of a miscommunication or a glitch. And nope, community does is like, no, nah, they're just, this isn't right. They're just telling you the wrong thing. Like, yeah, okay, I'll believe community notes over Coinbase.
Yeah, I mean, you can't hide anymore. Like, if it was mainstream media, they're pushing it one way and you can't respond.
Yep.
Twitter, that's not the case. Community notes kind of takes care of that.
Yeah, you're not going to get away from it.
Cash App also was in the news. They are no longer supporting sending Bitcoin between cash tags, which isn't super surprising. They're going to say you have to use the Lightning Network. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer from my perspective on that. Yeah, it will still work sending between cash tags, I guess, which is good. But, I mean, why not go to the Lightning Network? Why not use the blockchain of some sort to do that?
Good. I like the Lightning Network. I hope it keeps growing. I used it in El Salvador. It worked great. I like Jack Mallers. I like his attitude. I like his race to zero to squeeze out all of these people that, you know, basically extort people in order to transfer money around when it's really not that tough. So, like, I'm on board. Let's revamp the financial transaction industry. So anything that's good for Lightning, I think I'm on board with.
If there's anybody out there that's going to compare to Michael Saylor in terms of a Bitcoin bull, Jack Mallers might be pretty close to that.
Yeah, they both are very, like, you know exactly who they are. When they talk, they don't say anything that shocks you very much. Like, you're like, yep, this is exactly like Jack Mallers. He's angry that people have to pay $8 to transfer $50 from the United States to Latin America. Mm-hmm. And he thinks they should pay 2 cents. Like, and so if he puts Western Union out of business, he's more than happy to do that. And then, yeah, Michael Saylor is the same boat. Like, Michael Saylor is not going to say Bitcoin is going to take over the US dollar no matter what. It's a asset. It is capital. It is real estate or digital real estate, or, like, he is very on point with what he thinks. And he backs it with billions of dollars of decisions.
That is true.
21,550 Bitcoin is this week's update for MicroStrategy. And he bought them at 98.8. So he is not afraid to buy the top.
Yeah, it is 5 weeks in a row. And it's one of those things where I keep looking at it. And I'm like, God, is this last week's news that they're just recycling? And it's,
I'm no, having to look at dates. Yeah, because we do this every week.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane. I mean, it's great if you're in MicroStrategy, right? But it's still crazy how fast he's been buying after he announced, oh yeah, we're going to acquire 42 billion more. And he's taken care of 10 of that in 5 weeks or maybe even more.
Oh yeah. No, they're up to 423,000 Bitcoin, average price 60,000. So, I mean, if your average cost is under 60,000 for your Bitcoin stack, you got to feel pretty good. Like, you got a cheaper price than Michael Saylor. Now, Michael Saylor is getting at 0%, and these convertible notes are kind of a different thing. But, man, if you're MicroStrategy and if you're paying attention to MicroStrategy, Friday they determine if they're included in the NASDAQ 100. Well, that puts them in a bunch of ETFs that makes money just flow in, flow into the stock. And then, so that gets you into December. So people be front running, money comes in. And then in the first quarter of next year is when they're going to do the new FASB accounting. So all of the people that just can't spend the time to figure out MicroStrategy and this orange and this sea of apples, when FASB accounting comes around and they can just show their actual value, their spot value of the Bitcoin that they hold, instead of the worst price that they've seen, the lowest price that they've seen, all of their Bitcoin that they've bought over the last 4 years gets instantly brought to 100,000 or wherever the price is. So their earnings are going to look crazy to people that just use some spreadsheet or software to show earnings, that don't go through and read and look and do the calculations to figure out what their Bitcoin's worth. MicroStrategy, I mean, it's odd. It's sometimes Bitcoin price shoots up and MicroStrategy price goes down. You know, it's not like, but man, they're poised to make a pretty big splash, and it's contagious. Marathon did their second convertible note. Riot did a convertible note. I think Hut 8 did a convertible note. So these Bitcoin friendly, you know, Bitcoin oriented companies are jumping in with $500 million, $850 million convertible notes, just following the MicroStrategy playbook. So good for Bitcoin. Like, this works for me.
Yeah. And I mean, Saylor's message is kind of getting around. We talked about Microsoft and their possibility of adding Bitcoin into their strategic reserve. Amazon has a shareholder proposal that was submitted by the National Center for Public Policy Research, which I think is actually one of the same think tanks that got the Microsoft company to start looking at this. Mm-hmm. But they have proposed for Amazon to buy Bitcoin with 5% of their corporate assets to hedge against inflation. So, it's not a lot. I mean, they have what, 88 billion or so. So it's not huge, but it's still, if you have Amazon and Microsoft both buying Bitcoin, why is every other company in pretty much the world not going to follow suit? And then the whole long tail starts to get really interesting from there.
Yeah, I read that page from that document, and the two lines that stood out to me is that it indicated that it is perhaps their fiduciary duty to evaluate Bitcoin in lieu of cash. And I think that fiduciary duty to evaluate, I think that matters. I think that all of these companies and financial advisors that have a fiduciary duty, if you're ignoring Bitcoin, ignoring Bitcoin seems like an anti-fiduciary move. You need to at least evaluate it. Like, from a fiduciary standpoint, even if you're a broker, you need to be like, man, you know, real estate might be right for you. Like, that's your fiduciary duty, whether you make money on it or not. And so I'm kind of curious to see if that catches on and we see that fiduciary, because that wasn't in the Microsoft document. And if that catches on, then basically all the public stocks need to take a look at it. Even if you've got $50 million in your treasury and you're looking at a 5% allocation. So, and that was the thing too, like the line, even just 5% was like, that stood out. It's like we used to be 1%, right? Like, yep. 6 months ago, we would have been like, you know, the 1% allocation makes sense because of that. I think that the 1% is gone now. I think everybody's got to consider the 3 to 5% range as kind of the bare bones, you know, what you got to do to get a Bitcoin allocation.
Well, Florida has come out and said they're going to consider a strategic Bitcoin reserve in early 2025. And they're going to say 1% of their surplus to start. So they have $115 billion, right? So it's $1.1 billion to start, and then it'll go from there. And I can't see why Florida wouldn't do much more than 1%. They just need to get the ball rolling.
Man, anybody, if they do it in early 2025, anybody that gets an allocation of 1 or 2%, that allocation is going to become 2 to 6% by October, November. If it's a cycle, then yeah, it's going to crash back down and all this other stuff. But like, man, if all this money just keeps flowing in, because there's so much money that has zero allocation to Bitcoin, your 1 to 2% allocation, man, it's like, man, this thing's really taking off. This is saving our pension fund. We're going from underfunded to fully funded or overfunded. Like, this is our budget, our government budget. We have a surplus, you know, and yeah, you can sell some Bitcoin. The never sell your Bitcoin thing will start to erode in the next 12 months. You know, people are going to be like, look, you start to use it. Like, I mean, this, to me, this is a natural progression from store of value to medium of exchange. When you need to buy something, you can exchange your Bitcoin for it. Now, you shouldn't exchange your Bitcoin for dollars or euros and then just have those euros or have those dollars. But if you need something and you're looking at your assets and you determine that you want to sell a little real estate, sell a little Bitcoin in order to get the next thing, I think if we shift forward into you know, the next phase, I think it becomes like, yeah, this is what you do. That's why you preserve your buying power. It's buying power so that you can buy stuff. Like, and so I think that the people get in early, always works out better. If you have a long-term view, even better. And these states and countries and companies, everything is a long-term view. No, none of them are fooled by the volatility, thinking that it's risk, because they're not looking at this as a get in, get out, like try it, see what happens. It's like, no, we need to allocate to Bitcoin and then let it roll. Because I mean, these are reserves, right? I mean, if you look at that $88 billion that's sitting in Amazon's account, how long have those dollars been sitting? Some of those dollars have been sitting for a decade. Like, that sucks. Those dollars are worth a quarter.
Yep.
So yeah, get some of those out of there and balance it out. I think there was one investment house that said, if you had a 5% Bitcoin allocation and 95% cash, you had the best portfolio performance over the last 5 years. It was like, it doesn't take much Bitcoin in order to improve your performance. So, man, yeah, you allocate 2 to 3% into Bitcoin, and you're at least doing a good job in the long term.
So you talked about fiduciary responsibility and some of what the countries are looking at. Did you see the El Salvador meme where Bukele was sitting at his computer drinking coffee, checking his Bitcoin stash, and then the next image was him saying, I think I'm going to buy Guatemala, which that got posted on Twitter or whatever. And the Guatemalans apparently loved it because they love Bukele. So it's now turned into the Guatemalan government has realized, and both the government and the central bank are starting to look into Bitcoin and how to provide proper guidance for Guatemalans for this. So a little meme all of a sudden became a big deal for the government to take their financial responsibility, fiduciary responsibility, and actually help out the country of Guatemala as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is how it works. This is why El Salvador, when El Salvador got into this, and you and I are like, man, if you are a comparable state to El Salvador, whether that's in Latin America or Southeast Asia or Africa, if you're kind of in that, you know, 120, you know, to 90th GDP country, and you've got a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but no real tourism, and, you know, you're like, okay, what can we do? Then El Salvador does something kind of monumental, like add Bitcoin to the balance sheet and have it as legal tender. You got to be paying attention. But I mean, this goes to show Guatemala is not paying attention, because the Guatemala should be like, yeah, we've been talking about it. We you know, when me and Bukele get together, it's like they've been at zero this whole 3 or 4 years since El Salvador's been going. And now you got to look over and that your neighbor that was talking to you about Bitcoin in 2017, when it was $5,000, and is still talking to you about it now that it's $100,000. You know, it's like even the countries have to get punched in the face in order to see this thing coming. And it's wild, man, because like, I mean, when I was in El Salvador, like my cell phone pinged to a Guatemalan cell tower. So it was like, oh, welcome to Guatemala. You have 5 gigs of high-speed internet or da-da-da-da-da. I mean, I wasn't trying to go to Guatemala, and it was right there. Like, how in the heck for 3 or 4 years has Guatemala not been like, hey, you know what? Maybe we need to spend 2 days send some folks over, talk to y'all about the, talk to your Bitcoin people about Bitcoin, so just to get a little, just to get moving a little bit, just to see. It's like none of that happened until Bitcoin hits 100,000. Now everybody wants to learn more, but time, it's tough to learn, man. Time matters.
Yeah. It's like Canada or Mexico, not even talking to the US for 5 years, which I mean, that's just impossible for me to even contemplate.
Yeah. It's wild, man. But I mean, it's the same daggum thing as strategy doing this, you know, for years. And then these other companies like, oh, maybe we should look at this. It's like, oh, it's the best performing stock in, out of all the stocks. Like NVIDIA isn't doing as well as MicroStrategy. Like maybe look at it. Like you don't have to do it, but like watch a Michael Saylor video.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, we're talking about El Salvador, which is a small country. And I mean, I think out of the 10 or 11 countries that have Bitcoin on their balance sheet, they're the only ones that are still actively buying Bitcoin. Everybody else is mining or acquiring it by taking it from their citizens. But then you have a country like France. We've talked about France here a lot, which historically has been a country that's very high up on the list in countries that are doing well. And there's a senator that has proposed taxing crypto as a luxury good. And he's come out and said Bitcoin is unproductive, which means that what will happen if it gets taxed as a luxury good is that unrealized gains above 800,000 euros get taxed. And you sit there and think about this. I mean, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe I kind of understand this, but now with the way the world's going, all this is doing is pushing more crypto companies and more innovators away from France, right? What's crazy is the preliminary vote on this is actually already passed in the Senate. And I mean, you look at France, what, a couple weeks ago or whatever, they decided to ban Polymarket. So Polymarket isn't in the US and it's also not in France. So you can go to any other country in the world other than the US and France. And shoot, they went after privacy, right? They invited the Telegram CEO to come visit France. And as soon as he got there, they arrested him. So like, it's just, France to me is this big question mark. Like, what is going on there? Why is this happening? And all of a sudden, are we going to see in 10 years that El Salvador is a more powerful country than France is?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. They're just going in the wrong direction. So, you know, as a position, France is way ahead, but the trajectory is not great. I mean, France, they have an immigration problem. They've got a geopolitical problem. They've got a demographic problem. If you have a problem with your demographics, you need to be pro-crypto and get some young people wanting to stay in your country. You know, like if you look at Europe, everybody can move around real easily. So, you know, you've got like, this is a very unpopular view or legislation from anybody. If you're looking at getting into crypto or getting into AI, you need to be worried about this because your equity in your AI company could just be unproductive and unrealized taxed. And if you have a $500 million AI company that's unrealized capital gains, you got to come up with a whole bunch of cash to pay that tax bill. And if your AI company doesn't spit off a whole lot of profit, you're in trouble. So, you know, you can't let your country go in the wrong direction. It doesn't take long for things to fall apart. 4 or 5 years and you're in trouble. You know, else we mentioned El Salvador, we kind of have to talk about their IMF loan stuff. So, you know, they're not totally out of the woods on debt, but, you know, they just haven't gotten there yet. So I looked through it, I read the article. It seemed like that in order to get this next IMF loan and reinvest or refinance their debt, the IMF wants them to delegitimize Bitcoin. And it seemed like the only thing El Salvador gave them is that they're going to go from it's mandatory for businesses to accept Bitcoin to it's voluntary for businesses to accept Bitcoin. The article said that the IMF was urging them to not accept Bitcoin for taxes. It did not say that El Salvador is not going to accept Bitcoin for taxes. So I'm curious to see what they do and kind of how this thing pans out. But honestly, for me, I thought it was odd, and I didn't really like the fact that it was mandatory that businesses accepted Bitcoin anyway. That's not really the Bitcoin mantra. It's like, you have to understand that Bitcoin's valuable, and then you want it, so then you accept it. If you're just like, hey, you have to accept Bitcoin, whether you like it or not, I that's not really a great way to for adoption to occur. So to me, that's like throwing the IMF a bone in order to play ball a little bit. So we'll see how that goes. But you got El Salvador going in the right direction. Bukele's still very vocal about being pro-Bitcoin. You got France going in the wrong direction. You got the Czech Republic saying, hey, no capital gains on Bitcoin that you've held for 3 years. So that's going in the right direction. Yeah. No capital gains if you hold Bitcoin for 3 years is awesome, because you should be holding Bitcoin for 4 years at least.
Yeah. If there wasn't an exit tax to leave the U.S., that would be tempting to go to Czech Republic right now.
They got good beer. Like, it'd be easy to start a business. They got a lot of buildings, like ex-communist, like factories that are just kind of like sitting there. Like, if you wanted to start a company, Czech Republic wouldn't be a bad spot, because you can transport throughout Europe. So we had a manufacturing base for turbines in Czech Republic. And so it was like, this actually kind of works. Like, I've never been to the Czech Republic before, but you're kind of right here in the middle of everything. And everybody's, it's a hardworking culture. Like, it's kind of like, the ex-communist countries tend to have that, like, from what I've seen. It's like, they want to work hard and they want to grow stuff, because they at least have heard the stories from their parents about how bad it sucks when you're not allowed to do stuff and make stuff, or the government comes in and says, hey, you're not a shovel manufacturer anymore, you're a rifle manufacturer. Like, you don't have a choice. So yeah, look, man, these countries are going to realize that their people are a huge resource. And if you give those people some freedom and motivation to do these innovative projects in crypto and Bitcoin, watch what happens, right? The ones that want to make shovels and be customer service people, they're going to still do that. But man, you might have a couple thousand young people that want to start up some businesses in Bitcoin and crypto, and you might have some things take off. So, you know, you gotta set the environment if you're a country to let your people do stuff. And, you know, France isn't, and Czech Republic is now on the list of the ones that are. So, you know, that's one we have never talked about the Czech Republic on this podcast in 149 episodes, and now we are. So yeah, like, that's something.
And honestly, that's some of the most positive news that I've heard of coming out of a country in it, maybe ever, right? I mean, no one else is saying that. So that's huge for anybody that's in the Czech Republic or planning to move there, for sure.
Yeah. And honestly, if you're the Czech Republic, yeah, if you're going to day trade Bitcoin, then yeah, you're paying taxes on it. But if you're just holding it in order to beat inflation, then we're not going to tax you on it. It's totally fair. There's nothing that ticks me off more than when I make, then I sell something that I've held for 3 years at a 20% gain, and I have to pay capital gains taxes on it, but 20% doesn't keep up with inflation over the time that I held that thing. So my capital gains are actually break even. Yeah. And I got to pay taxes. So now I'm at a loss. It's garbage. So I'm totally fine. Like, I think that's a great move.
Yeah. So I guess sticking to the Bitcoin theme, there are some other things that I saw that were kind of interesting and funny. Peter Schiff, who is the huge gold critic that hates Bitcoin, has now officially labeled Bitcoin as a national security threat, which I think it was kind of funny. The president of the ETF store came out and said, in only 11 months, Bitcoin has evolved from a sinking ship to a national security threat. You'll love to see it. And I mean, the pretty much the thing that I look at here is Bitcoin. I mean, what's crazy is he's saying Bitcoin's a problem, not the $36 trillion in debt that we have, but Bitcoin, which is now almost $2 trillion in value around the world. But still, nobody's talking about our debt other than Elon Musk.
So my view of Peter Schiff is he has Bitcoin exposure. His son was into Bitcoin, something. This is just a shtick. This is just a marketing thing. He doesn't actually believe this stuff. It's just hyperbolic. Like, there's no way. I mean, I've listened to the guy talk, smart guy. I agree with him on a lot of stuff. You know, he's into gold. He's got like 5% of his net worth in gold. Like, what he says and what he does are very different things. So I think that it's engagement farming on social media. He gets a lot of, you know, he says these inflammatory things and he gets a bunch of comments and blah, blah, blah. And he gets to go on podcasts and he gets to debate Fred Krueger in a Twitter spaces. Just, you know, guess what? Now he's got more people looking at him, more eyeballs, and that's better for him. So I have gotten to where I think Peter Schiff is just kind of like the Bitcoin jester almost. Like he's got his own bit, and he comes in and he does his routine, and it's like it kind of makes me chuckle a little bit, and then we move on.
Fair enough. So, kind of going back to Michael Saylor, he had an interesting question here recently. His suggestion was for the U.S. to sell all their gold, which would probably tank the price of gold, and buy 20 to 25% of the Bitcoin network to really catalyze the development of the World Reserve Capital Network. So that would be really interesting. I mean, it would force Chinese and Russians and everyone else that would have to buy Bitcoin. And then his view is that all that money would flow into the U.S. And if you remember back in 2020, Grayscale did an ad for you to drop gold and buy Bitcoin. I think Michael Saylor is kind of recycling that ad right now.
You want to talk about a real strategic move to, okay, we sanctioned Russia. We eliminated the value of their treasuries. Other countries then stopped buying treasuries because they're worried that if we don't like them, we just devalue their balance sheet. Then they buy gold because that's kind of like the backstop to the U.S. treasuries as far as a reserve asset. Well, then you tank the price of gold and buy Bitcoin, and then they have to sell their gold at a loss to chase you buying Bitcoin. You know, like that's like when you're the gorilla in the room, you get to make the rules. That would be a crazy move geopolitically, but it would work.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So I think we haven't really talked much about Ethereum lately either. And Ethereum has some great things happening that, I mean, it's probably outpacing Bitcoin right now here recently. The inflows into the exchanges are at the lowest point they've been in a month. The total value locked, they added $8 billion this week, which, I mean, compared to the next two closest people were Tron and Solana. And Tron did, I think, $900 million, and Solana did $618 million. So it is just, I mean, the progress that's happening on Ethereum and the amount of action that's happening on Ethereum continues to grow at exponentially larger sizes than the next guy's closest to him.
Yeah, I have ETH breaking 4,000. It was on my radar because it was like sleeping giant, man. I mean, it's the number two crypto. And so like on my trading view watch list, it's, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, Solana, and I'm like, Ethereum just isn't moving. And you know, I don't pay attention to what's going on in the ecosystem and how many people are doing what on like I know that it's like part of the infrastructure of crypto and Web3 and all this other stuff, but I'm like, if the price isn't moving, it doesn't have my attention, because all I see is the ETH on TradingView. And I knew that the inflows to the ETFs were picking up. But I'm like, man, the price is moving. So anyway, it broke 4,000, you know, and once, you know, that's kind of close to the all-time high from 2021, something in the low fours. You know, so Bitcoin's 30%+ above its all-time high. Ethereum's getting close to its all-time high. So I would assume that there's a little bit of expectation that people think, okay, well, Ethereum ought to be going to 5,000 just to pace Bitcoin. And it hasn't yet. So I, you know, I'm always curious if Solana is going to start to erode and take over some of this Ethereum stuff. And I don't know enough about it to, you know, I know a lot of the meme coins are moving to Solana and but you know, price matters to a lot of people in crypto. And you know, if you're not paying attention to the guts, it's kind of like MicroStrategy stock. If you're not reading, you know, page 10 of the earnings reports, you know, it doesn't make sense. And so it's probably the same with Ethereum and Solana. If you're not seeing what's going on, you know, behind the scenes, then it's kind of tough to determine which one's got more value. But it is good to see Ethereum starting to move a little bit. I still think the people that are like, there's not a lot of people talking about being Ethereum maximalists, but there used to be. And there's a lot of people that had a ton of their net worth in Ethereum. And I'm like, every time I see Vitalik, I'm like, no way. But it's good to see a move. I mean, it's like I have 7-year-old Ethereum that I actually unstaked because I'm like, this is going to get converted into Bitcoin or it's going to get converted into dollars and is so that I don't sell Bitcoin, I'm going to sell Ethereum. So I Googled to see if I could find out if there is a where I could find if Ethereum is being unstaked, because, you know, you got to wait a few days or at least hours in order to unstake it in order to sell it. So if I would think you could kind of get a read on if people are looking to sell Ethereum by who's unstaking it. But I also just gave up. I just stopped looking for it.
Yeah, there's definitely a place to do that. And it's been a while since I've looked at it, but the amount that was being staked was continually rising. It doesn't have the, it used to have the, was it like 2 months you had to wait to be able to stake it just because it had so much in the backlog. So you would assume something like that would happen in the future if everybody tried to unstake at the same time, but maybe with the new sharding and all that, it happens faster. We'll see. So Grayscale was also in the news. They had a Solana trust. They're planning to move to an ETF. Not that that's huge news, because there's, what, 4 or 5 other companies that have talked about creating a Solana ETF. Gary Gensler's parting gift, I think, to the entire crypto industry seems to have been blocking these latest Solana ETFs for at least another multiple months. He just filed an 81-page brief in the Binance case, pretty much stating that crypto had no inherent value and there were a handful of coins that were securities. I guess he can't get out of here soon enough, in my opinion, but I think this is just something that Paul Atkins is going to have to deal with when he gets on board in January.
Yep. It's tough for me to figure out how you justify having a Ethereum ETF and not a Solana ETF. So get out of here. We'll move on. I think allowing people to have exposure to digital assets is part of what the SEC should do. And all the work is done for them. All they need to do is say, okay, if people invest in these Solana ETFs, they're backed by actual Solana. If Solana tanks, they lose money. If it goes up, they make money. Like everybody's playing by the rules. Instead, it's like, no, you can't do that. All right, move on.
And we haven't talked about Celsius in a while, but their CEO just pled guilty and agreed to return $48 million to investors as part of his plea deal. So he'll be sentenced in April and he could get up to 30 years of prison time at that point. So be good to get that behind us, because I think I'm just tired of dealing with that as well.
Well, crooks go to jail, so they should probably go to jail. Like maybe he's a good dude and he just got caught up in it. But, you know, if you're the reason a lot of people lose money, then you get to take the heat. Like that's part of being in charge. You get to reap the benefits and you get to take the blame. 30 years is a long time, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. He could get 30 years and SBF only got 25.
Yeah.
Did a lot more worse, in my opinion.
Right. Celsius might not have collapsed if FTX wasn't such a fraud.
Yeah. So there were a handful of positive news that I feel like happened in the industry. And so I had 4 or 5 of those that were really interesting to hear. I know you probably maybe have not even heard of it, but Hedera, Hashgraph, they just integrated the world's first crypto automotive marketplace. So Crypto Autos, which has about 20,000 luxury cars across 600 dealerships, and you can pretty much go buy these cars with crypto. I mean, the benefits of Hedera is it has near zero transaction fees and instant finality. So it's a pretty cool project. They use more of a distributed ledger technology rather than a blockchain, but it's just exciting to see that they're starting to get some traction in some industries as well.
Yeah, cool. See if it works.
Heatbit, I don't know if you've heard of them, but going back to the Bitcoin side of the world, there is a company that created a heater, a miner, and a filter to put in your house. So it handles about 400 square feet. You plug it in, it's actually quiet, which is kind of weird for a Bitcoin miner to be quiet. But it creates a lot of heat, and they use that heat to heat your house. So it's about $900 to buy the heater, but you end up getting about 20,000 sats per month from a mining perspective by having it plugged in. So kind of interesting, kind of expensive for a heater, but I mean, it would actually provide more Bitcoin miners out there keeping the network going. So that's also kind of a good thing too.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the decentralization of miners, you know, needs to be improved as mining gets consolidated into these monster public mining companies. So yeah, having a little miner in your house, $900 is kind of cheap for a miner, especially in a quasi bull market. Normally, I mean, $900 doesn't buy you any kind of miner. Now, yeah, you're not running a 240 volt, but you get to plug it into a wall. Like, you don't have to figure out, like, I mean, I was rewiring my air conditioning unit to run my Bitcoin miner in the winter in the basement to keep my basement. Like, nobody else is going to do that. Like, you need to have just like, hey, this is just a real expensive space here that also mines Bitcoin. You get 20,000 sats per month over the course of, you know, 100,000 sats in 6 months. You know, you can kind of run the numbers. That's not terrible. Yeah. And if you're running an electric space heater anyway.
Well, it's funny. I looked at their website and they have almost like three buttons you can press. What if Bitcoin is at its current price of, it's called 100K? What if it goes to Cathie Wood's prediction? And what if it goes to Michael Saylor's prediction? What does that mean? And so it's kind of fun to see that.
Well, the sooner you buy that heater, the better off you are. Like,
yeah,
if you mine right now at 100,000, that's way better than mining 6 months from now at 200,000.
Well, and I think it depends on where do you live, right? Are you going to have it plugged in for 2 months out of the year or 10 months out of the year?
That's true.
So one of the other things that I like paying attention to is some of the new products or projects that are out there doing kind of new innovative stuff for blockchain based. And there's a company called Spexy. They just raised $11.5 million. They're this innovative blockchain based fly to earn network. So I think it started back in like 2017. And their goal is to take this aerial imagery industry and build out a scalable global network of drone pilots to capture and deliver really frequently updated, data-rich Earth and fully standardized imagery to both the public and the private sectors. And doing this with the drone means it's pretty much near zero emissions. So I think their ultimate goal is not really just to replace the existing satellite image use cases, but really opening up a bunch of new markets in the whole geospatial, insurance, AI, public safety, government gaming. And so it would be kind of interesting. I mean, I know when the hurricanes came through, I was trying to get updated imagery on where my dad's house was and to see what had happened when I couldn't reach him. So something like this would be kind of cool. And it's exciting to see that there are things like this happening. And actually, listening to Andreessen talk about how the US had killed the drone industry, this is probably not the same drones he's talking about, but a way to help grow some of the drone space in the US too.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I can get behind that.
And then the last couple things I had were on Cardano. We haven't really been talking much about them, but there's been some interesting news here in the past week. The first one being they had a Doom tournament. I don't know if you remember playing Doom back in the day. They launched this tournament on their Hydra platform, which is their layer 2 scaling. And they had, I mean, I think they're giving away $100,000, but every image was a different transaction on the blockchain. So they had a bunch of people playing. They ended up getting over 1 million transactions per second on their network, which I think now is the fastest network out there. So it's kind of exciting to see that Cardano is theoretically now the fastest network out there, blowing Solana out of the water. And then on top of that, they just had their constitution, the Cardano constitution, has been accepted. They had over 95% of the delegates say yes. So starting in January, they're going to put all the text on chain, and then the vote to ratify that will happen. So that's kind of a big deal and been a lot of years working to get to this point. And now it's going to get to the point where things like other governments could theoretically be run on Cardano, which will be exciting to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cardano has kind of been that one of the older crypto company token organizations that just like people kind of view it like do something or don't. And they're, you know, getting in the news. This isn't the first time Cardano's hit my radar in the news. So that's, you know, good for them for making a little splash. Now's the time. If you're a crypto organization, now is the time to start making some noise and get your name back out there, because it's coming, right? We did it in 2021. We're going to do it again in 2025. if you're like even the Bitcoin or the crypto trader guys are like, just throw a dart and pick some crypto. They're all going to go up, you know? So, but if you can position yourself so that you're in the news, you're making progress, you're delivering value, something's useful, I think there's a lot of gains to be made over the next year.
Well, I mean, you talked about you're not a huge fan of Vitalik and Ethereum. If you look at Ethereum and who started that, one of the main guys that started it was Charles Hodgkinson, who went out and started Cardano because he wanted to improve on Ethereum. And kind of the guy that wrote the white paper on Ethereum ended up went and started Polkadot, right? So Ethereum isn't perfect. I think those guys agree with that. And they've tried to make better versions of that. They're just a little bit further behind Ethereum and will take some time to get caught up.
Yeah, that's fair. But again, Cardano's price has shot up and for quite a while. I mean, if you let price kind of determine like what you feel like the market is telling you, I feel like Cardano has quite a bit of strength.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at it, they were 30 cents or so, just over 30 cents back in early November.
Yeah.
And now they're over a dollar. I mean, shoot, they hit $1.20 at one point. So, I mean, it's pretty exciting. There's not many companies out there that are doing 4X that are that's the size of Cardano, right? So, I mean, that would be like Bitcoin going to 200K already.
Be a big deal.
Yep. So, well, cool. What else did I miss on my end?
The one thing I had in my notes that I thought was kind of funny is the Financial Times had a very brief, maybe 5 or 6 paragraph article that was their air quotes apology. You know, basically Bitcoin hit 100,000. We're sorry if you were dumb enough to listen to us and not invest in Bitcoin. That's when I read it. That's basically what I got out of it was like, you know, the Financial Times, you know, we provide information and, you know, you make your decisions. And it's like, if you were stupid enough to listen to the Financial Times, then you got nobody to blame but yourself for missing out on Bitcoin. And honestly, you know, it kind of made me think like, yeah, if you're using old school tools to make decisions in 2024 as to where you put your money, that is fault. Like, if you're not using Twitter to pay attention to even stocks, if you're waiting on, you know, your broker, the news portion in your broker quote to tell you what's going on in your stocks, yeah, you're not really trying here. And so yeah, I think if you're looking at what to do in 2025, I don't think looking at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, you know, if that's exclusively where you're getting your information, then you kind of deserve to get left behind.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the broker stuff, and I mean, I know a lot of those guys. I think they're great, but they're limited on what they can tell you. So they can't tell you about penny stocks or something like that that's new and exciting because they're not allowed to do that. So they're going to try to go with the safe ones and the Microsofts and all those companies out there today. So awesome. Well, as always, an exciting week in crypto, and I'm kind of excited to see what happens not only in the next week, but shoot, in the next month or so as we start to get some of this new administration on board and start seeing what really happens. And hopefully this outgoing administration can't put any more daggers in anybody's back before they leave type thing.
Yeah, I think we're going to have more and more things to talk about over the next few years, the next year. It's pretty fast. And the more companies get pulled in to the MicroStrategy plan, the more countries that get pulled in, we're gonna run out of little things to talk about. We're gonna be busy talking about only big things.
Yeah, I mean, I kept hearing there's supposed to be another country that's been buying Bitcoin that's not telling anybody that once they finally come out and dox themselves, then it's gonna be the race will begin for countries, I think, right? So
I'm ready, man. Let's see. Yeah. Let's watch it.
Exactly. Cool. Well, we'll talk next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jason.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers
including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below and hope to see you there.